Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Recurring attacks by armed groups in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, continue to drive forced displacement and extreme hardship for millions of Congolese, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Friday. The country has 6.2 million internally displaced people, while more than 1.3 million have become refugees. UNHCR said that Goma, the capital of eastern DRC's North Kivu province, hosts over 560,000 displaced people in and around the city. Many live in spontaneous sites on the side of the road in dire conditions despite the efforts of humanitarian actors. Here's Elizabeth Tan, UNHCR's Director of International Protection, who recently returned from North Kivu.
I spoke to a woman there who has five children. She didn't have any food even for that day, and so she had sent her children out to collect firewood and to try and make a little bit of money, and her main concern was, would they come back, and would her girls come back without having suffered an attack?
UNHCR warned that the lack of adequate sanitation and overcrowding are fueling risks of cholera and measles outbreaks while people desperately try to survive. Widespread hunger and child malnutrition are looming in northeast Nigeria as the lean season is set to begin next month. As the period between harvests where people struggle to meet their food needs draws closer, UNAIDS Coordination Office OCHA said on Friday that 4.3 million people in the conflict-affected states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe will likely face severe hunger between June and August. Almost 600,000 people could face emergency levels of food shortages. OCHA also says that an estimated 2 million children under 5 in the three states are at risk of wasting, the most immediate and life-threatening form of malnutrition. The UN World Food Programme, WFP, is scaling up to provide food and nutrition assistance to over 2 million, while the UN Children's Fund is providing therapeutic treatment to severely wasted children. However, more funding is urgently needed. Humanitarians in northeast Nigeria require $1.3 billion to provide assistance this year, but have so far received just over 11% of that amount. A UN plan to prevent a catastrophic oil spill from the Safer tanker off Yemen's Red Sea coast received additional funding on Thursday, the UN Development Programme, UNDP, said. Some $8 million in pledges were announced at an event co-hosted by the United Kingdom and the Netherlands on Thursday, but close to $24 million more is still needed for the operation's emergency phase to be implemented by UNDP starting this month. Due to the conflict in Yemen, the tanker has decayed to the point where it could explode or break apart, which would have disastrous effects on the region and beyond, UNDP said. In an appeal for funding to support the salvage operation, UNDP Chief Achim Steiner said that $20 million now could save $20 billion in potential costs later. Millions stand to suffer in the event of an oil spill from the FSO Safer. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Good evening, listeners. We took a short break here yesterday on some technology matters. It's not a big deal. Good to hear you. Good to have you on board for the show. Coming up on Free Thought Friday today.
For radio as secular as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We celebrate the National Day of Reason, Judy Blume, and court reform.
Then we talk with agnostic Bible scholar Bart Ehrman
about his new book on Armageddon and how end-time beliefs pose a danger for humanity.
That's right. Coming up after these latest headlines from Democracy Now!,
welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Fighting in Sudan's capital Khartoum has intensified as the Sudanese army battles the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group for strategic locations. The UN's top humanitarian official, Martin Griffiths, arrived in Port Sudan this week, where he called on combatants to allow the distribution of critically needed relief shipments to millions of civilians trapped by the fighting.
We need access. We need airlift. We need supplies that don't get looted. World Food Programme today, James, informed me six trucks of theirs, which were going to Darfur, were looted en route despite assurances. of safety and security. So it's a volatile environment.
The UN says the violence has forced 100,000 civilians to flee their homes with critical shortages of food, water, medicine, and electricity. In Washington, D.C., President Biden signed an executive order Thursday authorizing sanctions against Sudanese leaders. The order came as the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, told the Senate panel Sudan's conflict is likely to be protracted as both sides believe they can win militarily and have few incentives to come to the negotiating table. In Ukraine, the head of the Wagner Group says he'll pull his Russian mercenary forces out of the besieged city of Bakhmut by May 10th after he blasted Russia's military for failing to provide enough ammunition. Yevgeny Prigozhin said in a statement, Wagner's remaining troops will withdraw to logistics camps to, quote, lick our wounds. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has accused the United States of planning what it said was a drone attack on Wednesday aimed at the official residence of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The White House dismissed the allegations as ludicrous. A jury in Washington, D.C. has convicted four members of the far-right group Proud Boys of seditious conspiracy and other felonies for their role in the January 6th Capitol insurrection and for attempting to keep Donald Trump in power after the 2020 election he lost. The Proud Boys verdict is seen as a major victory for the Justice Department. During two previous trials, six members of another far-right group, the Oath Keepers, were also convicted of sedition. We'll have more on the Proud Boys after headlines. ProPublica reports billionaire Republican donor Harlan Crowe paid 2 years of private school tuition for the grandnephew of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who failed to report the payments on his annual financial disclosures. Tuition at the Hidden Lake Academy in Georgia cost over $6,000 a month. ProPublica previously reported Crowe also paid money to Thomas and his relatives in an undisclosed real estate deal and that Thomas accepted luxury travel from Crowe virtually every year for decades, while failing to follow a federal law that requires him to publicly report most gifts. Meanwhile, The Washington Post reports conservative judicial activist Leonard Leo arranged for Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, to be paid at least $80,000 for consulting work over a decade ago. Leo asked the Republican pollster at the time, Kellyanne Conway, to bill the payments to a nonprofit group Leo advises and specified that Ginny Thomas's name should be left off any paperwork. That same year, in 2012, the nonprofit filed a brief with the Supreme Court in the landmark case Shelby County versus Holder, in which Thomas cast the deciding vote in a 5-4 ruling that gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In Pakistan, at least eight people were killed in two separate shootings in the town of Karam Thursday. Gunmen stormed a government school, opening fire, fatally shooting five teachers and two construction workers. Another teacher was killed after the vehicle was ambushed on a nearby road. No one has claimed responsibility. In Serbia, President Aleksandar Vučić has vowed to completely disarm the country after at least eight people were killed in a mass shooting near the town of Mladenovac on Thursday. The suspect opened fire from his moving vehicle. He was arrested earlier today. The latest massacre came just a day after a 13-year-old boy went on a rampage at his school in the capital Belgrade, killing eight students and a school guard. The boy was using guns that belonged to his parents, who have both been arrested. The attacks have sent shockwaves through the Balkan nation, where mass shootings are extremely rare. The last one happened in 2013. Hours before Thursday's shooting, protesters gathered outside the education ministry in Belgrade demanding justice for the school shooting victims.
I am sincerely sorry that Serbia is now on a list of countries where things like this happen. And it has changed the feeling of going to school for all children and everyone who works there. Some mothers had to send their kids back to class today. How can they explain to children that they can safely go to school? How can we explain it to them? There are no words for something like this.
Though Serbia has strict gun control laws, thousands of illegal weapons flooded the streets following the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. Back in the United States and Georgia, at least three people were killed in two separate shootings Thursday. The gunman is accused of killing his mother and grandmother at their homes and a McDonald's manager in Moultrie. The suspect then took his own life. This came a day after another shooting in Atlanta that left at least one person dead and four injured. In Oklahoma, authorities said Wednesday they found the bodies of seven people at a home in Henrietta. A man who was convicted of rape and was facing a child sex abuse trial is suspected of shooting dead his wife, his three children, and two teenage girls who were there for a sleepover before taking his own life. The youngest victim was 13 years old. Meanwhile, in California, a former UC Davis student was arrested Thursday in connection with three recent stabbings, including the killings of an unhoused man and another college student. The 21-year-old suspect was charged with murder and attempted murder. The two victims have been identified as David Bro, who was unhoused and a beloved figure in Davis, and University of California Davis senior Kareem Abu-Najim. Wall Street regulators halted trading in shares of PacWest and Western Alliance Thursday after shock prices for the regional banks fell dramatically after the stock prices fell. The plunge raised new fears about the health of the U.S. banking sector following the collapse of Silicon Valley and Signature Bank in March, and just days after J.P. Morgan Chase purchased First Republic in a fire sale after it became the second largest bank to fail in U.S. history. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds on Thursday pledged to sign a bill rolling back child labor protections. Among other things, the legislation will permit children as young as 14 to work in construction and demolition jobs if a guardian has granted permission. In Washington, D.C., Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders called Thursday for a 32-hour work week with no pay cuts for U.S. workers. Senator Sanders also said he'll introduce legislation to more than double the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $17 an hour.
In the year 2023, in the richest country in the history of the world, nobody should be forced to work for starvation wages. That's not a radical idea. If you work 40, 50 hours a week, you should not be living in poverty. It is time to raise the minimum wage to a living wage.
In North Carolina, the Republican-led Senate has passed legislation that would ban most abortions after 12 weeks. Republicans quickly approved the measure less than 2 days after it was introduced. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper has vowed to veto the bill, but the legislature's GOP supermajority likely has enough votes to override him. Under current North Carolina law, abortions are legal for up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. The state has been a safe haven for many people living in the South who need the procedure, as most states in the region banned abortions after the Supreme Court's gutting of Roe v. Wade. Here in New York, protests continue amidst mounting anger over the killing of street performer Jordan Neely, who was choked to death by another subway passenger Monday while being held down by another two riders. Neely, an unhoused 30-year-old black man, was crying out that he was hungry when he was fatally attacked on the train. No one has been arrested or charged despite the death being ruled a homicide by the medical examiner. Neely was a beloved fixture of the New York City subway for his performances impersonating Michael Jackson. A number of lawmakers have joined the chorus of voices condemning the vigilante-style murder. And Mayor Eric Adams, who's demonized and cut services for home unhoused people and mental illness, will flood while flooding the train system with police. New York City Council Speaker Adrian Adams said in a statement, quote, racism that continues to permeate throughout our society allows for a level of dehumanization that denies black people from being recognized as victims when subjected to acts of violence. Any possible mental health challenges that Jordan may have been experiencing were no reason for his life to be taken. And as King Charles prepares for his coronation Saturday, indigenous leaders in former British colonies are calling on the monarch to apologize, pay reparations, and, quote, acknowledge the horrific impacts on and legacy of genocide and colonization of the indigenous and enslaved peoples, unquote. They're also demanding the repatriation of the remains and cultural artifacts of indigenous peoples. The letter to King Charles is signed by groups in Antigua and Barbuda, Australia, the Bahamas, Belize, Canada, Grenada, Jamaica, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia, St. Vincent, and the Grenadines. Britain was one of the largest slave traders in the Atlantic in the 18th century. Senior Jamaican government official Marlene Malahou-Fort spoke with Sky News Thursday.
Why not a full apology? Is it because you may have to give back the wealth of the monarchy taken from the people, taken from the places that were colonized, taken from the places where the people were enslaved? It's personal for people. The policies that are racist and unjust by virtue of nationality and ethnic background and the color of your skin. That's just not right.
Minister Malahou Fort said the coronation has accelerated plans for Jamaica to become a republic, with a referendum taking place as early as next year. The coronation ceremony will cost British taxpayers up to $125 million at a time where many are struggling to pay for basic living expenses. This week, the Home Office Police Powers Unit wrote to anti-monarchy groups planning peaceful protests, warning them about new criminal penalties and expanded police powers that were rushed into law ahead of the coronation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Here's a short reminder of tomorrow's program.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour, every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade, it's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Wyoming, drunk men came hurrying through. Well, Britannia's Huns with her long-range guns came in through the foggy dew. Back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore. For I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Gaylor. This is Free Thought Radio, and happy National Day of Reason.
And I'm Dan Barker, and you're going to explain that in a moment.
Yes.
National Day of Reason. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and this is the May 4th, 2023 episode of Free Thought Radio. May the 4th be with you. Grant Blaschka with Audio for the Arts is our engineer in the Stephen Uhl Friendly Atheist Studio in Freethought Hall, which is the national office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
And the Freedom From Religion Foundation produces this weekly show, Freethought Radio, and FFRF has over 40,000 non-religious members in North America, and one of our purposes is to serve as a membership group for non-believers, for dissenters, for none of the above people who are personally free from religion. But the bulk of our work is to keep religion out of government, as the U.S. Constitution, the secular, godless Constitution, requires. And we'd love to be 50,000. We'd be glad to send you information if you click on the Ask for Info link at our website, or you can join us at ffrf.org.
Today, we're going to talk about the end of the world. Our guest in the second half of the show will be the best-selling New Testament scholar, Bart Ehrman, whose new book is called Armageddon, What the Bible Really Says About the End.
And then before that, we're going to talk about book censorship, especially Judy Blume's books, and describe the new movie we went to see last weekend, and we urge you to do that too. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
That'll be a fun conversation. This Sunday is the anniversary of the birthday of the Russian composer Peter Tchaikovsky. He was born May 7th, 1840. Toward the end of his life, Tchaikovsky gravitated toward agnosticism. Listen for some of Tchaikovsky's music today, including the Piano Concerto No. 1, Romeo and Juliet, and the 1812 Overture.
So, back to our happy day of reason. Many of you might know that the Freedom From Religion Foundation has valiantly sued over the National Day of Prayer, which is the first Thursday in May, and Congress orders the president to tell us all to pray and what to pray about. And I didn't even look up what Biden's proclamation says, but
that's today, right?
Yeah, that's today. But for several years, Representative Jamie Raskin, who is a co-chair of the Congressional Freethought Caucus, has been introducing a National Day of Reason. He's usually made it the day after, and I was so pleased to see that this year he and Representative Jared Huffman, who co-chairs the Congressional Freethought Caucus, made it the same day. So it counteracts the day of prayer, and I love the resolution at the end that supports a National Day of Reason, encouraging all citizens, residents, and visitors to join in observing this day and focusing on the central importance of reason, critical thought, the scientific method, and free inquiry to resolve social problems and promote the welfare of humankind. So much better than looking to a deity to solve our problems for us.
He could have ended it with, "Nothing fails like prayer."
And so for that reason, the lobbying arm of FFRF, the new FFRF Action Fund, has named Representative Huffman and Jamie Raskin our Secularists of the Week. And you can read more about that on the FFRFAction.org website. And then, Dan, you had a sudden trip to D.C. on Monday. Tell us what that was all about.
Well, so I went at the invitation of a coalition of groups who were having a press conference on the lawn right outside the Senate building. FFRF's Director of Governmental Affairs, Mark Dan, arranged for us to be at this press conference of a lot of groups who care about court reform.
So this was on Tuesday, just before the Senate Judiciary Committee held its hearing about court reform.
Right, and then Chief Justice Roberts, you know, was invited to testify at that hearing, which he should have done, but he declined, citing the separation of powers.
So we all know about the many scandals of ethical impropriety, and today yet another revelation from ProPublica about Justice Thomas receiving yet another gift from that billionaire Harlan Crow that was undeclared, paying for private schooling for one of his relatives. And, you know, Justice Roberts' wife has a conflict of interest. We have a new low in public opinion about the Supreme Court, only 25% of Americans saying they have a great deal of confidence in the court. So, Dan, let's listen to your remarks.
Thank you. I'm Dan Barker, co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. And we support Senator Whitehouse's and Representative Hank Johnson's Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, and Senator Padilla's Judicial Ethics and Anti-Corruption Act. If those ethics rules are good enough for the makers of the law, they should be good enough for the judges of the law. It's not just billionaires and corporations, it's also religion that comes before the courts. And we are alarmed that the current court just turning its back on decades of secular precedent in order to privilege religion. FFRF's more than 40,000 members. We're mostly atheists and agnostics, but we also represent the religiously unaffiliated, who are now about a third of the American adult population. But with no openly non-religious justices on the court, our government does not truly represent the rapidly changing demographics. We desire and deserve a truly secular government.
Yes.
Not one that's captured by the Christian nationalists and the religious extremists. Our Constitution prohibits the government from establishing or promoting religion, but the courts are now being packed with judges who are not neutral, who are turning the freedom of religion into the weaponization of religion. The separation of powers, as has been noted earlier today, does not mean insulation of powers. It means checks and balances. When the Chief Justice declined to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee on these very matters, he signaled that the current Supreme Court does not want to be checked. But if there's no check, there's no balance. FFRF is pleased to stand with our partners here in calling for meaningful court reform.
So good job, Dan. And of course, Senator Durbin at that hearing said it follows that the highest court should not have the lowest standards. And the subject of court reform is the timely topic of the newest episode of the podcast, We Dissent. And that is a podcast put on, it was the brainchild of our legal director, Rebecca Markert. She's joined by FFRF counsel Liz Cavell and American Atheists attorney Allison Gill. And it's a monthly podcast. You can get it wherever you get podcasts, so you don't want to miss that one. Speaking of Capitol Hill, this week on FFRF's Ask an Atheist Facebook Live show, the topic was the timely lobbying for change on Capitol Hill. It was hosted by Liz Cavell, along with FFRF attorney Chris Line and FFRF state advocacy specialist Ryan Dudley.
Chris talked about his recent visit to D.C. to lobby for FFRF's Action Fund on behalf of the Do No Harm Act, which would prohibit believers from using religion to discriminate against and harm others due to religious beliefs.
And during the show, a member of the live audience asked how FFRF decides what issues are relevant to state church separation. Let's listen to a little of Chris's and Liz's responses.
A few years ago, we polled our membership, and most of these issues, you're talking 95%+ of our members support, you know,
right,
as atheists. So
right,
it just kind of shows these are sort of the things that people care about because, you know, as atheists, the issues matter, you know, to atheists.
Well, it goes
we
back
that
to the kind of the, all the rhetoric around the Day of Reason, right? It's not, that's not just quotes in a press release. It's like, that's what makes secular democracy so vital to we non-religious people and many others who support secularism, mm-hmm, even if they're religious, which is that right, reason guides our policymaking and our government action. And reason is not prevailing in all of these efforts in the LGBTQ space and in the reproductive space and so many others.
And of course, when religion gets involved in these social issues, reason tends to disappear.
You can watch that Ask an Atheist show on FFRF's YouTube channel. Just look for the Ask an Atheist playlist.
And a new episode of Ask an Atheist airs almost every Wednesday at 12 noon Central on Facebook Live on FFRF's Facebook page, where you can ask questions during the show.
And we did mention the secularists of the week. Briefly, I want to talk about the theocrat of the week, and it's quite a story. It's a Kansas state senator, Mike Steffen, who, when he was asked a question about diversity and representation by a Muslim constituent, said, well, we'll play what he said.
No, I'm a Muslim woman, and there are people who are Asian. So what would you say to those people who are kind of against a more biblical approach to certain laws?
Well, I'd be happy to try to convert you.
Unbelievable. And this is, he's a very much a Christian nationalist, radical anti-abortion, wants God and government. Mike Steffen, he was named the Theocrat of the Week by FFRF Action
if
Fund.
He would want to convert us atheists and Muslims. So we have a TV show called Free Thought Matters, and this week Annie Laurie talked about religion and abortion with Professor Tiffany Green. She's in the Department of Health and Sciences in Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Green is an economist, a pop health scientist with expertise in reproductive equity.
So Professor Green, who is a secular humanist, and she lives here in Madison, Wisconsin, she's at the university, she told me that women of color are much more adversely affected by religiously motivated abortion laws, including our ban here in Wisconsin, and I did ask her specifically about their health in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, after Roe fell, after the Supreme Court decided that the right to an abortion was not guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution, Wisconsin reverted to a law that had been passed in the 19th century to prevent anyone from having an abortion unless the pregnant person's life is in danger. It has caused a lot of confusion. We've heard some stories that have been reported in the newspaper about people that have life-threatening situations, and doctors were very uncertain sometimes about whether they could provide the care that was required. I do want to say that many people in Wisconsin were in a post-ops world far before the actual decision. Wisconsin has a disproportionate share of the population that has to get care at Catholic health facilities. And what that means is that they cannot get reproductive health care. That is a standard. So here's where you have religious beliefs interfering with the right to have full-spectrum reproductive health care.
Yeah, Tiffany was great. You can watch that episode of Free Thought Matters right now on the playlist for Free Thought Matters at FFRF's YouTube channel.
And if you live in one of the cities where Free Thought Matters is broadcast on TV, you can watch that show every Sunday morning. For stations and times, check out ffrf.org/Free Thought Matters, which you can also find on the news dropdown on our FFRF.org homepage.
And speaking of abortion, a very dramatic, a poignant, very wretching testimony by Amanda Zerosky. She was one of five women who is suing the state of Texas over its restrictive abortion bans and because of their pain and suffering because they were denied abortion. The case was filed in March by the nonprofit Center for Reproductive Rights.
And at a hearing last week of the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary on the impact of the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe v. Wade, Zerosky told lawmakers that her experience might prevent her from having children in the future, and it has definitely affected her mental health.
I wanted to address my senators, Cruz and Cornyn, neither of whom regrettably are in the room right now, but I would like for them to know that what happened to me, I think most people in this room would agree, was horrific. But it's a direct result of the policies that they support. I nearly died on their watch. And furthermore, as a result of what happened to me, I may have been robbed of the opportunity to have children in the future. And it's because of the policies that they support. What happened to me was horrible, but I am one of many. And quite frankly, I'm lucky. I'm lucky that I have a husband that could take me to the hospital. I don't have other children that I had to worry about finding health care for. I have a job that was understanding that allowed me to grieve for 3 days as I waited to almost die. What about all of the women that don't have those same opportunities, that don't have access to health care, that don't have health insurance, that don't have a partner? What about them?
She went on to say, we've heard a lot about the mental trauma and the negative harmful effects on a person's psychological well-being after they have an abortion, supposedly. And she said, I'm curious why that's not relevant for me as well. Denied a life-saving abortion and nearly dying because of the delays.
Shows the harm of religion in our laws. So we only have a minute left to talk about some FFRF news. Sammy Lawrence, one of our attorneys here, wrote a letter opposing a major public school participation in an upcoming Mormon Utah event. As many as 18 Utah schools are participating in this Hope of America event at Brigham Young University, which is the Mormon university. An employee of the schools contacted us complaining that there was overtly Christian prayer in Jesus' name, and so we are writing to ask them to discontinue that connection with that religious event. A couple of victories also, letters that Sammy wrote. FFRF has ended the teacher involvement in a Kansas Christian school club. It's a Fellowship of Christian Athletes club. And somebody complained about it. And so we wrote to the Northeast Unified School District saying, students should be leading these clubs. And they wrote back telling us, you're right. It was wrong.
There's a federal law even saying that teachers can't lead those clubs.
So they're telling the teachers that it has to be student-led.
And one more victory, right?
In California, our charter school promises FFRF that from now on, their ceremonies will be secular, because there was a speech that was filled with the Christian Bible and Christianity and all of that. And the school wrote back and said, you're right. It was wrong to have that speech, and we've notified that our ceremonies will be secular.
So after the break, we're going to talk about Judy Blume, and then we will be interviewing Bart Ehrman about his new book, Armageddon, What the Bible Really Says About the End. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor here with Dan Barker.
Hi, I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom from Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. And last Friday, Dan and I went to the theater on the opening night of the new movie, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, based on Judy Blume's 1970 book for girls that's often been banned. And here's the trailer.
Are you there, God?
It's me, Margaret.
I'm here to speak to you today about your changing body.
The blood is released through the vagina.
Please, just do this one thing for me. Let me just be normal and regular like everybody else. Just please, 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 please.
What I've seen.
I've decided I want you to join my secret club.
If you want to be in the club, then you have to wear a bra.
Oh. You think you need one?
Are you okay? You can tell me the truth.
Fine. Good. Yes. We have the Campus Improvement Committee. Any volunteers? Social Committee. Fundraising Committee. And how are you?
I read that when you don't have any loved ones around, your life expectancy drops drastically. But, you know, I've had a good run.
It's tiring. Trying so hard all the time, doesn't it?
I don't know if I want to do this. Just so we're ready. Please, God, let it be a lady.
Any of us will look like that when we're 19?
We must increase our bust!
So actually, this film is about menstruation. And it describes how this clique of 11-year-old girls are obsessed about when they're going to get their periods. And this is why the book is banned. And we have a little snippet of Judy Blume this spring talking about this.
I am so disheartened at what's happening today, that we are right back in the 80s when it comes to book banning, except that it's much worse, much, much worse, because it's been politicized, it's a lot of it's coming from government now, and, you know, as terrible as it was in the 80s, and I went through it, and it was awful, it's even worse now, very scary, and unless we all speak out, it's going to happen.
So speak out by buying a ticket, first of all, because it's a way to fight back against book burning.
Yeah.
But it's a fabulous film. I'm not sure that That quite came through in the trailer, really a little gem.
You heard Kathy Bates in there playing the Jewish grandmother.
The mother's McAdams. I've forgotten the actress.
Rachel
McAdams, the little girl is fabulous. But, what's going on is that yesterday the state of Florida legislature passed a law that you cannot even mention anything about sex education, including menstruation, until the sixth grade. It's extraordinary. It's vile. It's not preparing children, and it's unbelievable. And Judy Blume has called attention to this bill. So this movie couldn't have been released at a better time. We have to fight back against this stuff. And of course, the governor has said, he likes to wear the full armor of God. So of course, he's going to sign the bill. And this whole squeamishness about menstruation comes right out of the Bible, to calling women unclean and making something of shame that you can't talk about. And the bill would not even allow this little clique of 11-year-old girls to talk about it in school. It's not just in classroom instruction. It's draconian. It's also extending the Don't Say Gay ban to eighth grade, more book banning in this bill. It's a terrible bill, and this kind of thing is sweeping the country.
Well, what if a fifth grader started her period and the teacher wanted to talk to her about it? She'd be prohibited?
Yes, and we should have played. There's Representative Gant who questioned the sponsor of the bill on that. What if a fourth grader, 9-year-olds can get periods, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, would the teacher be prohibited from mentioning it? And he said, yes.
Mm-hmm.
This is unbelievable. It's just the dark ages. So we have to fight back and go see this movie. Everybody should go see it.
It's not just about menstruation. It's also about wearing bras and growing up. And it's also about religion. Religion comes into
it
quite a bit.
Yes, the parents are non-religious. They are the nuns. And her talking to God is a device so that she lets her true feelings come out. It has a very free thought message.
So we're going to take a break. And after the break, we're going to talk with New Testament scholar Bart Ehrman, the author of many books about the Bible. His newest book is called Armageddon, What the Bible Really Says About the End.
I'm Steve Pinker. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I show that the world has become a better place as reason has been overcoming superstition and tribalism. But the values of the Enlightenment are under attack. That's why I'm a proud member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest association of free thinkers working to keep state and church separate. Please join me in supporting the Freedom From Religion Foundation to ensure that our government is driven not by religion, but by reason.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Is the world going to end any minute like a thief in the night? Our guest today has something to say about that. Bart D. Ehrman is known to many of you listeners. He's the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in the Department of Religious Studies. He served as both the Director of Graduate Studies and the Chair of the Department. As an expert on the New Testament and the history of early Christianity, he's written or edited 30 books at least, numerous scholarly articles, and dozens of book reviews.
Professor Ehrman has written several textbooks for undergrad students, many trade books for general audiences. 6 of his books have been on the New York Times bestseller list, including Misquoting Jesus, God's Problem, God Has a Lot of Problems, Jesus Interrupted, Forged, and How Jesus Became God. Bart Ehrman's newest book, which just came out in March, is called Armageddon, What the Bible Really Says About the End. Thank you for joining us today, Bart.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I want to know, as a Bible scholar, according to the Bible, is the world about to end at any minute?
When the biblical writers were writing, they said it was going to end any minute in their day. I guess that much is true. The difficulty is that today, most people who read the Bible thinking about the end of time are conservative evangelical Christians who think that when the New Testament writers say that it's going to happen soon, that they mean soon in our day. But obviously, they were writing 2,000 years ago, and they meant soon for their day. So part of my book is trying to explain that the New Testament's not actually describing what's going to happen in our future.
Yeah, and one of the things you write in your book, I really enjoyed the book Armageddon for a lot of reasons, but you point out that if those so-called prophecies were meant for our day, then the author writing to his own audience expected them not to understand anything that he was talking about, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, the book of Revelation is a very bizarre book, and people have trouble understanding it. But one thing is pretty clear. The author actually addresses Christians in seven churches that he knows in what's now Western Turkey, and he's directing a message to them. And there's nothing in the book to suggest that he's not thinking about the audience he's writing to. And when you think about it, any of us writes a book, you know, you're writing it for our audience. If you write a book, you're not writing it for somebody living 2,000 years from now.
Well, who knows? Maybe someday somebody will interpret one of your books like that, 2,000 years from now.
Yeah.
You were talking about them. So who is John? Some people thought he was the John of the Gospels. Who was he?
Well, he wasn't the person who wrote the Gospel of John, and he wasn't John the son of Zebedee, the disciple of Jesus. He just calls himself John. John was a popular name among Jews at the time. We don't learn much about him. He's on the island of Patmos, which is off the west coast of Turkey, and he says he's there because of tribulation for the word of God. And people have taken that usually to mean that he was exiled there because of his Christian activities, but we don't really know that. He's just on this island for some reason, and he's writing this book, and we don't have any other information about him except for what's actually in the book. But we know he wasn't the author of the Gospel of John, because he's a very different author with a very different point of view and a very different writing style.
Well, now, I haven't read the Revelation recently, but my conclusion was that the person who wrote it was barking crazy or on something.
Yeah, people ask me if there were hallucinogenic mushrooms available on Patmos. And, you know, the deal is it does seem so unusual to us and so weird that it seems like this guy's really off his rocker. But in fact, it's not like that. There were lots of books written like this at the time. It was a genre of literature. And it's kind of like the way I usually try to tell it to my students is that if you took a science fiction novel today and you put it back, you know, had somebody in the 1700s read it, they'd think it's the most weird thing they'd ever heard of. But for us, it's just kind of a typical way of writing, it's a thing we read. And apocalypses, like the Apocalypse of John, were fairly common in Jewish and Christian circles, and so the readers would have known what to make of it. So even though it seems really bizarre and weird to us, it was an established genre of literature at the time.
And he was drawing, obviously, from Daniel and Ezekiel and from other previous apocalyptic writings. You can tell that, can't you?
Yeah, he clearly is deeply embedded in some of this visionary literature of the Old Testament, and I think you're right, especially the Book of Daniel more than any, but Ezekiel as well, and some of the others. And so this is, you know, as again I say, you know, it is it's highly symbolic, and it seems mysterious. But part of the thing I try to do in my book is explain why it is not that difficult to understand if you understand how ancient apocalypses work. And you understand about his own historical situation, the book just opens itself up. There are some pretty clear indications of what he's actually talking about, and it's not what's going to happen in the year 2024.
One thing that I didn't know actually until I read your book was that the Greek of the Revelation is really bad and sloppy. Which isn't that one of the reasons why they know it wasn't written by the gospel writer?
Yeah, even in the ancient world, there were Christian scholars who knew this. There's a scholar in the 3rd century who wrote an entire treatise on this that says just this, that who, on linguistic grounds, he demonstrates it can't be the same author as the person who wrote the Gospel of John. And the Greek is bad. I mean, the Greek throughout the New Testament is usually okay. It's good. I mean, it's not good by high literary standards of the ancient world, but it's decent Greek. John, whoever wrote this book, John of Patmos, does not have very good Greek. The last time I taught a class of Greek to classic students here at UNC, I gave them an assignment to read Revelation chapter 1 and to list all the grammatical mistakes.
Yeah.
And they're just mistakes.
Well, that's a good way to learn the language.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, what scholars have typically said is that he doesn't write Greek very well because it's a second language for him. They say, you know, maybe he spoke Aramaic or some other Semitic language, and so Greek isn't his first language. And I used to think that, but then as I studied it more and looked more deeply into it, I came to the conclusion the guy just can't write very well. And that's not weird. I mean, back in that, in that period, 98% of the world couldn't even do as well as he did, and so he's educated. It's just he does. Now, I have a lot of really smart students at Chapel Hill who don't write worth beans, and so you know he just doesn't write very well.
So I wanted to ask you about this word rapture that you know today's apocalyptic writers are always talking about, but it doesn't. That word you say doesn't appear in the Bible.
No, it doesn't. And it's not taught. It's not only does the word not appear, the concept does not appear in the Bible. People are really, you know, amazed by that, and they don't believe me. But I show it in my book that the passages that, you know, that we all thought when we were evangelical, when I was an evangelical Christian, I was firmly convinced in the rapture, and I was firmly convinced the Bible taught it.
Well, the Bible, we will meet Jesus in the sky. Doesn't it say that in the New Testament?
Yes, it does. And so that's exactly right. But what does it mean? And so in the doctrine of the rapture is that Jesus comes and rescues his followers from the world before the period of tribulation hits the earth. And that is never talked about in the New Testament. The passage you're referring to is 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, where the dead in Christ will rise first, and then the other living followers of Jesus will meet him in the air. If you read the passage in its context, Jesus is not coming to take his followers out of the world before the tribulation. He's coming to destroy all of his enemies on earth. And his followers join him then in celebrating afterwards as they enter into the kingdom of God. So it is not a being taken out of the world before the world's destroyed. It's when Jesus actually returns in glory to set up his kingdom on earth.
Well, that's so vengeful, isn't it?
Oh, boy. Well, the book of Revelation, I mean, you know, I often have people tell me, just people all the time say, that the Old Testament has the God of wrath and the New Testament has the God of love. And when they tell me that, I just ask them, you know, have you read the book of Revelation lately?
Yeah.
You talk about wrath. The term love of God never occurs in the book of Revelation. The term God doesn't love anybody in Revelation. The terms that are used are wrath, vengeance, revenge, blood, murder. It's really nasty terms.
Well, billions of people apparently are all killed by this angry Jesus in the book of Revelation.
Oh yeah, most of the planet is destroyed, and the only people who survive are the ones who are called the slaves of God, the slaves of God, and they are they're the ones who not just believe in Jesus but follow the Christian teachings that John agrees with. Other Christians are going to suffer the fate of everyone else, which is that a lot of them are going to be killed on earth. Then all of them will be raised from the dead, and the vast majority of the human race will be thrown alive into a lake of burning sulfur.
So it's like saying, if you're not a Southern Baptist like me, even if you're a Christian, you're going to hell, right?
Well, that's right. And sometimes it gets extreme, even more extreme. You know, I knew a guy once who said that if you weren't baptized in my local church,
Well, we just interviewed Michelle Dowd, who wrote the book Forager, about a family cult, apocalyptic cult.
She thought the world was going to end in 1977.
And it was really only their family that was going to survive.
Well, we have to take a break, Bart. I hope the rapture doesn't occur before we come back or we can't finish the show. We're talking with Bart Ehrman, the Bible scholar.
And I think we want to ask you about the harm of these teachings in today's society.
Yes.
The book's called Armageddon, What the Bible Really Says About the End. We'll be right back.
This is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. And we're continuing our conversation with Bible scholar and author Bart D. Ehrman, whose newest book is called Armageddon, What the Bible Really Says About the End. And the Bible is focusing on the New Testament, the last book of the New Testament, the book of Revelation. So, Bart, very briefly, can you tell us what is the book of Revelation about? Who is this Babylon and who's Jezebel and all these weird characters that are appearing in the story?
Well, the book is basically about how God is going to destroy all of his enemies on earth and wipe out all the forces that of evil in order to award his reward his followers with a blessed kingdom forever. But it means that the author is opposed to just about everybody who's he's opposed to everybody who's not a follower of Jesus like him. The main enemy in the Bible, in the book of Revelation, is called Babylon. Babylon was the city in the Old Testament that destroyed Jerusalem and burned the temple. And in John's day, the city that destroyed Jerusalem and burned the temple was the city of Rome. If you do a careful study of Revelation, as I do in my book, and explain, the enemy, the ultimate enemy, is not some kind of future antichrist or some kind of modern 21st century national nation. It's the city of Rome in his own day that he's predicting God is soon going to destroy. The Roman city, the empire, the emperor will be wiped out. But it's not just the Roman emperor. I mean, you mentioned Jezebel. Jezebel is mentioned in the book of Revelation as a woman who's a prophet in one of the churches that John knows. So she's a Christian leader, a Christian teacher. And we don't know what her real name is, but he calls her Jezebel because that's the name of a wicked queen of Israel in the Old Testament. And he thinks that this prophetess is wicked because of what her teaching is. She's teaching Christians things that he disagrees with. And he says because of that, Christ is going to take her. In fact, Christ himself says this in a letter that he writes to Jezebel, where he says that Christ says that he will throw her on a bed and men will come and have sex with her, and the men, Jesus will plague the men, and then he will kill Jezebel's children. Huh. This is Christ speaking. It is not a very good image. It's, Jesus throwing her on a bed.
Yeah.
Some translations call this a hospital bed or a sick bed. It's not that. It's a bed that she has sex with other men on, either willingly or unwillingly, and the result is that Jesus then kills her children. This is, yeah, it's not a very, very nice.
He sounds like one of these kind of crazy college street preachers who come and yell at the women, you know, that they're all whores. He sounds like he's kind of like Ezekiel pulling people's hair out and stuff.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is that it isn't that this woman, in fact, was sexually licentious. It was that this woman that he's calling Jezebel is teaching people in her congregation or telling people in her congregation that it's okay to associate with non-Christian pagans and to have meals with them where you eat meat together. That's her sin.
That's her sin. Wow. Well, now, you have this whole chapter on the real-life consequences of the imminent apocalypse, and I would like to turn to that. Why do you say the end-time beliefs are significant for the fate of humanity?
Well, for the state of humanity, it's rather a big point. It's kind of the climax of that chapter, because I also talk about things like psychological damage it does, emotional trauma, and including the effect that the belief in the imminent end has had on U.S. foreign policy, of all things. But there's a big deal about the fate of the planet, too. Evangelical Christians, as you probably know, have been disproportionately opposed to legislation for climate change, to control climate change, and for environmental issues. And I trace the history of this phenomenon. Why is it that evangelicals in particular don't want to protect the planet, or don't think that it's really an issue, or don't think it matters? It's because, and there's a lot of research on this, I'm not making this stuff up, there's a lot of research on it that shows that evangelicals who think Jesus is coming back simply don't think there's any reason to be worried about whether the sea levels rise or the ice caps melt or that, you know, or with weather patterns that change, because it's God's going to take care of it. So we don't need to worry about it. And that's dangerous.
You quote Pastor John MacArthur saying, this is a disposable planet. God can just throw it away and create another one.
Wow.
Yeah, well, we may throw it away and there may not be another one.
We also just saw the anniversary, a significant anniversary about Waco. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, most people our age remember the disaster at Waco 30 years ago with David Koresh. Most people don't realize how significant the Book of Revelation was in that entire thing, because Koresh was actually driven by his misinterpretation of the Book of Revelation. His entire movement was based on the idea that they were fulfilling the prophecies of Scripture found in the Book of Revelation. And, of course, the FBI had no idea what he was talking about when he was going off trying to expound the Book of Revelation to them. But he really thought that he and his group were going to be martyred, and it's why they didn't surrender. They didn't give in. And so they got slaughtered.
And it was, of course, this is haunting us. We've seen Trump hold a rally there speak to people, who are still thinking about Waco. I mean, we saw what happened with the Oklahoma City bombing.
Yeah.
That was 2 years later.
Yeah. I know. I think, a lot of politicians have molded their political views around evangelical concerns and end time concerns, and in very strange ways, but it's documentable. And it's because the evangelicals, since the 1970s, have really pushed to get the vote out, and they push certain agenda issues, and these issues then influence politicians who really do not have any kind of evangelical leanings or even Christian leanings at all. But to appease the evangelicals, they take stands on issues that even ones they don't believe in order to get the vote.
And I'm assuming you're talking also about the U.S. policy on Israel?
It's partly that. I mean, I don't take a stand on the Israeli-Palestinian issue in the book, but it is interesting why, historically, are evangelicals so firmly committed to the nation of Israel when, in fact, they think that most Jews are going to go to hell. What's that all about? And what it's about are biblical prophecies that say that Jesus can't come back until Israel controls all of the promised land So you can't have the Palestinian territories there. There can't be a two-state solution. And that the Antichrist can't come back until the temple is rebuilt, which has to happen on the Temple Mount where the Dome of the Rock currently is. So the only way for Jesus to come back is to destroy, for Israel to take over the Temple Mount, destroy the Dome of the Rock, and build the temple. Then the end can come. Boy, you talk about World War III. That's, if you take out one of the holy, you know, one of the most holy sites in Islam to rebuild the Jewish temple, that ain't going to work.
Now, we only have about a minute left, Bart, but
less than a minute.
Your book says there's a poll in 2010 that indicated nearly half of all Christians believe that Christ will definitely or probably return by 2050. So this is really cause for concern.
It's a huge cause for concern. And I actually, you know, I am not opposed to Christians. I'm not opposed to Christianity. But I do think that some Christian beliefs lead to terrible harm, just as other religious beliefs do. And this is one of them. If you're basing your entire reality on the fact that it's going to end soon, it changes your political and social views in ways that are usually detrimental to people at large.
So thank you, Bart Ehrman. The new book is called Armageddon, What the Bible Really Says About the End. Thanks for being with us today, Bart.
Thank you.
And we also want to thank you listeners to Free Thought Radio at WOOM in Philadelphia, to WZML in Bryn Mawr, to WID and WMUU in Madison, Wisconsin, WADR in Janesville, Wisconsin, KEOS in College Station, Texas, KZSM in San Marcos, Texas, KOPN Columbia, Missouri, KEPW Eugene, Oregon, WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WRIU in Kingston, Rhode Island, WRFI in Ithaca, New York. And if you're listening to the podcast, give us a thumbs up on your provider and tell your friends and family to learn more about Free Thought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
And ask for more information at ffrf.org. You can support Free Thought Radio by becoming a member, but you're actually supporting so much more, FFRF's legal work to keep religion out of government and to educate the public about free thought. So check us out at our website at ffrf.org. You can request a sample issue of the May periodical Free Thought Today, the May issue, and tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope so.